Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. This is On Air Daily News for Wednesday, January 25th, 2023. I'm Naima Latif, and we are joining a live White House briefing. Many are on hand to get an update on the U.S. and its position on the war between Russia and Ukraine and other issues of national and international concern. Let's join White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre live now.
Responding in lower press. Okay, as you saw, the President made a bit of news today on our continued support for Ukraine alongside our allies and partners. My colleague here from the National Security Council, John Kirby, Admiral Kirby, is here to take some of your questions, and I will welcome him to the podium. All right.
Okay. I don't have any opening statement. I am just happy to take whatever questions you have.
All right. Go ahead, Brian.
Thank you very much. Hi, Kirby. Thanks a lot for doing this.
Yeah.
My question is about the direct budgetary assistance the U.S. has supplied to Ukraine. President Zelensky recently fired senior leaders in Ukraine over corruption concerns.
Yeah.
Is the U.S. confident that direct budgetary assistance has been used properly in Ukraine?
As you know, that budgetary assistance is directed through the World Bank, and we're confident in that process. We obviously share President Zelensky's concerns over these corruption allegations, and it's apparent that he takes it seriously. That's important. We'll obviously let him work his way through that. But in terms of the budgetary assistance, like I said, it goes through the World Bank. We're comfortable with that process.
We have not seen any signs
that our budgetary assistance have fallen prey to any kind of corruption in Ukraine, and I would go so far as to say the same on the security assistance side as well, the weapons and the systems. We are obviously working in lockstep with the Ukrainians on accountability measures on that and see no indication that anything we've sent over has ended up in the wrong hands or being used inappropriately.
We're going to jump around.
For a long time, U.S. military officials had resisted this move to send in front of tanks, saying that they're difficult to operate, difficult to train people on, and that was essentially what we heard from President Biden today. What changed?
So a couple of things. You're right. We've been completely open and transparent about the sophistication level of the Abrams tank. It's, as the President said, the most capable, powerful tank in the world. And a lot goes into making it the most capable tank. So we've been very honest about that. There's training that's needed. There's sophisticated maintenance requirements. There's a supply chain. I mean, it uses a gas turbine engine, basically a jet engine, 1,500 horsepower. So there's a lot that goes into operating these tanks on the field. That said, we never ruled tanks out. We have been, from the beginning of this war now 11 months ago, been evolving the capabilities we're providing with Ukraine with the conditions on the ground. And so when you're at, to get to your specific questions, what's changed? What's changed, Kristen, are the conditions on the ground. And the kinds of fighting that the Russians are doing right now, and the kinds of fighting, more importantly, that we believe the Ukrainians are going to need to be capable of in weeks and months ahead, well into 2023, well into this year. And that's why we're doing the combined arms training outside of Ukraine for battalion-sized units. Combined arms maneuver, that's a fancy title, but basically means being able to integrate your ground capabilities, whether that's armor, artillery, even some degree small air defense systems, integrating command and control logistics, integrating all that to fight on the ground, particularly with open terrain. That's why armored vehicles were so high on the list for the Ukrainians, and tanks are armored vehicles. So this very much just follows right along with the kinds of discussions we've been having with the Ukrainians for months about making sure that they can fight on the terrain that they're in and that they can prepare for operations going forward this year.
And just to follow up, it was part of the calculation, because obviously there's been this robust back and forth between the U.S. and Germany. Part of this about giving cover to Germany and other European allies to allow them to send in tanks.
I wouldn't use the word cover. What what this decision does do is show that how unified we are with our allies and partners, and doing all of this in a coordinated way. So today you saw that Chancellor Scholz announced that they're going to provide immediately a company of Leopard tanks. A company is about 14, and there's two companies to a Ukrainian battalion, and he's going to be working with allies and partners to get additional companies of tanks, Leopard tanks, into Ukraine. It's about coordination. It's about the unity here and the resolve that we all have together to help support Ukraine.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Bessie. Could you get a little more specific about how many tanks the Ukrainians would like to have? I mean, I know you're going to say it's their decision, but obviously you're communicating with them the whole time. How many they'd like to have to get what they want to do done, i.e. these counter-offensives? And do you think they're going to get there with this whole hodgepodge of different Western contributions?
So you're right, I'm not going to speak for President Zelensky. I think if he was up here instead of me, he would tell you he wants as many as he can, as fast as he can. So the battalion that we're going to provide, that's 31 tanks, and that's for a Ukrainian-sized battalion. An American battalion has more tanks in it, but the way they're organized, it's about 30 to 31 tanks. And again, the Germans are going to help organize another two battalions, so that's about 60 more, roughly. And that's just what was talked about today. The Brits have agreed to send some of their Challenger tanks. You heard the president talk about the French and their contributions to armored vehicles. So there's a lot that's being applied to this. And armored vehicles are important. You know, you don't go after a crocodile with a corn stalk. And these vehicles, these tanks, those armored vehicles, they're going to have an effect.
Okay, but just given the goals which are approaching pretty quickly, right? If there's going to be a spring offensive, we're talking maybe in a couple of months or so. Do you feel confident that the Ukrainians are going to get to where they want to be in terms of the armor for these combined arms maneuvers to talk about?
I can go so far as to tell you that it is our goal, and a goal shared by our allies and partners, including in the phone call this morning that the president had. That we accomplish exactly that goal, that we get to Ukraine the capabilities they need to be successful on the battlefield today, but just as critically in the future, going forward this year. Because right now, I mean, it's wintertime, so the conditions are not great. There's some fighting in the Donbas, but other than that, there's not been a whole heck of a lot, at least down in the south. But as the weather conditions improve, you can expect that the Russians are going to pick up the tempo. We have to be ready for that, and I know the Ukrainians feel they have to be ready for that. So it's about helping Ukraine defend itself, but also, as you heard the president say, helping Ukraine be able to go on the offense when the weather conditions and when the operational conditions are permissive. Does that answer your question?
Thank you very much.
And then
I'll come to this is kind of a follow-up to everybody's question. How much of the U.S. announcement today was a diplomatic effort versus actually the battlefield capability effort in the months ahead when these 31 tanks can be delivered?
Both. There was a lot of diplomacy that went into the announcements today. You know, I know we've all been focused on the last few days and things that have been said publicly, but actually, I mean, the effort, the decision you saw today by both Germany and the United States was several weeks in the making through many, many discussions with the Germans and with our allies and partners. But it also, there's a military component here too, Phil. I mean, I get it. I get where you're kind of going is these tanks are not going to get there for many months, and I understand that. But those Leopards won't take quite as long to get there as the Abrams. And we're not wasting the time. I mean, even as we procure these tanks, we're going to be, the Pentagon will very soon start doing the training for Ukrainian tankers, Ukrainian troops that man tanks, so that they can be ready to receive once those tanks are on the battlefield. Another point that's worth making is it's not just about how to operate the Abrams, to Kristen's question. It's how to maintain them, and it's how to build in, have an organic supply chain process, a logistical sustainment process, so that you can keep them maintained and in the fight over the long haul.
That's one quick thought. We always hear after announcements like this, and you talked about the progression of the battlefield conditions have changed, the Russian threats of escalation, or talking about crossing red lines. Do you feel like those threats at this point are both just part of the course, but also somewhat empty?
You mean the Russian threats?
Yeah, they don't seem to stop anything.
Well, we don't, I mean, look, we don't just take anything for granted when they say it, and we're not dismissive. That said, these tanks are meant to help Ukraine fight effectively on open terrain to defend their sovereignty and their territory and to win back territory that the Russians have taken from them. And as the president said, they don't represent an offensive threat to Russia. Do they represent a threat to Russian soldiers? You bet they do. But not to Russian soldiers that are in Ukraine, not to Russia proper.
Thank you, Kevin. Hi, John. Actually, still ask my question, but...
Oh, good. So we can go to the next one.
I follow up on that. You know, the expectation that these tanks will be delivered within months, at least 4 months. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. But the reports that the Russians might launch a counterattack now. Do you see this as a catalyst for the Russians now to launch an attack, to escalate the war in a way to stop them before they reach, before they receive these tanks, if they're going to make any change in the war?
I never do well if I try to speak for the Russians and try to get inside their head and what their intents are. What we do believe, all I can tell you is what we believe, and that is that the Russians, Mr. Putin, will use the winter not only to conduct operations, which he is in Bakhmut and Soledar, but to use it to regroup, to retrain, to re-equip, and to prepare himself for continued fighting when the weather improves. So we want to make sure that we're using this time as best we can, A, to help the Ukrainians in the fight that they're in today, but make sure that they're ready for the fight tomorrow, that they're ready to defend themselves against whatever offensive operations the Russians might be planning to do when the weather improves. So, again, I can't predict perfectly how this is going to go, but this is very much, you know, some of the criticism I've heard, and I've heard it when I was at the Pentagon too, is, you know, it's hand to mouth, and you guys aren't thinking ahead, and it's just whatever the need is for today. And this decision today is very much indicative of the president's long-term commitment to Ukraine and how he has tasked the national security team to think ahead, to plan ahead, to help the Ukrainians get ahead of what's coming down the pike.
Can I follow up on that?
Two quick follow-ups. You noted that our military aid to Ukraine has evolved with conditions on the ground, and the president previously said that these M1 Abrams were needed to liberate Ukraine. Does the administration expect any operations moving forward that would include retaking Crimea or lands that were lost during the Russian invasion?
I'm not going to talk about Ukrainian operations. I would just never violate their operational security and certainly wouldn't divulge from the podium what their plans and intentions are. I will only say this, that we do not dictate to the Ukrainians how they operate, where they operate, what missions they conduct, what targets they choose. We help them with usable information and intelligence as best we can so that they can be successful, but these are their decisions to make. It is their country, their war. Our job is to make sure that they can prosecute that war successfully.
And I want to follow up to make sure that I understood you correctly. You said previously in your assessment of both military and economic aid to Ukraine that at this point, thus far, you haven't seen any signs of corruption or misuse?
Correct.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how the U.S. settled on the number of tanks it's providing, 31? That's
yeah.
A very specific number.
I kind of got to it a little earlier. It's basically the size of a Ukrainian tank battalion. And I'm getting a little bit astray of my knowledge. I was a naval officer, but as I understand it, an American tank battalion has about 50 tanks in it, and it's organized with more companies that comprise the battalion than in Ukraine. It's just the way the Ukrainian army is organized. It's not right or wrong. It's just that their battalions are basically, I believe, two companies. So they're just smaller. And so two companies, that's about 15 tanks a company, and that's how you get to 30, 31. And then, you know, usually at least one of these tanks is the commander's in there, and so you've got a command and control tank that sort of is in charge of how they're operating on the field, and now I'm really, really going astray of my expertise. But I think that's about as far as I can go.
The Ukrainians said today, thank you very much. Now how about some fourth-generation fighter jets? What are the chances of that happening?
We're in constant discussions with the Ukrainians about their capabilities, and as I've said, we evolve those as the conditions change. Can't blame the Ukrainians for wanting more and more systems. It's not the first time that they've talked about fighter jets, but I don't have any announcements to make on that front.
Go ahead, Christina. Is there a concern that if any of these tanks were to fall in Russian hands, they would have access to the latest U.S. technology?
There's always what we call tech transfer concerns, I mean, that would be the case with other systems that we have provided to Ukraine. But, and this doesn't kind of get to the corruption question, but not really. We just haven't seen any indications that any of the material that we've provided Ukraine isn't being stored appropriately, used appropriately, maintained appropriately, and being fought with appropriately. We're just not seeing that happen. But is that a potential risk? It's always a risk in war. It's a risk when we fight a war. But that's why we're working so closely with the Ukrainians on accountability. And we've really increased our efforts through the Defense Attaché's office in Kyiv to work with the Ukrainians on accountability so that we have a better sight picture on where these things are at any given time. But it's a war, and you can't forget that. I mean, it's a war.
Thanks, Grant. Why not take the Abrams out of existing stocks to get them there faster? Is there a reason that you want more training before that happens, or is there some U.S. need that you want to keep?
The Pentagon insists that they don't have any excess Abrams in their inventory, that all of them are gainfully employed, if you will, for our own national security defense. And even if there were excess tanks, the process of getting them to Ukraine, to prepare them for use by the Ukrainians, to train Ukrainians, to put all the parts and supplies in place, would take many months anyway. So it's not like this procurement process is really costing us any time than if we just drew them down out of our own stocks. But the real reason is we just don't have them. We don't have excess tanks. The second thing is, and this is not unimportant, is that, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, when they get there, we want to make sure that they fall on ready hands and that the Ukrainians know how to use them. They know how to keep them running, and they've got the supply chain in place for spare parts and supplies and anything else they need so that they can be more effective on the battlefield.
And given the process, what's the soonest the Abrams could get there?
The Pentagon, I think, talked about this earlier today. There's no date certain on the calendar. I think what we're looking at is what's probably going to be many months before they're actually there.
Okay. Thank you. Josh, so to your point about longer-term planning and absorption risk from Ukrainians, and also picking up from Sebastian's question about the number of tanks, the advisor to Zelensky's office, Mykhailo Podolyak, actually told my colleague after this announcement that what they want, what they need is about 200 to 350 tanks from the West. So is that a realistic number? If not now, maybe in the future, if the Ukrainians should happen to prove that they can absorb these initial tranche of tanks and they can maintain it?
I don't think it's wise to get ahead of where we are right now. We are focused on working on this program to get them, procure them these 31 Abrams tanks, to include all the supplies and parts that go with it and the training that's required to operate and maintain them. And we know, certainly based on the conversation the President had this morning, that our allies and partners in Europe are likewise focused now on moving additional armored capability to include these now German Leopard tanks in a shorter period of time.
To be clear, the future shipments of tanks is not off the table.
We are focused on the announcement the President just made today.
Just one more really quickly. He also said that the next step for Ukrainians will be to request extended range missiles. Is that also under consideration?
We are in constant conversation with the Ukrainians about their capabilities. I don't have any announcements to make.
With many months being the time frame, is it fair to say that these tanks will not be available for use for the spring offensive? And secondly, one of the concerns in the lead-up in the debate about this was fuel concerns. How is that being dealt with?
Well, that's part of the supply chain issue, isn't it? I mean, it's a jet engine. It's a gas turbine engine, which needs jet fuel. So there's a specific type of fuel that powers the Abrams, and we've got to make sure that pipeline, literally and figuratively, is available to Ukraine. So that's going to take some time as well. And look, I'm not going to predict date certain on the calendar. It's going to take many months before the tanks get there. And let's not get ahead of specific spring offensives. We do think as the weather improves, the Russians are going to want to increase their tempo. We want to make sure that the Ukrainians can not only meet that tempo, but be capable of their own. And what that looks like and when that starts or where, that's really up to President Zelensky and his military advisors. We wouldn't speak to that. Only thing I'd add to that, Amr, is that these Leopard tanks won't take quite as long to get on the ground. And again, I'll let the Germans speak to this, but they won't take the same length of time that the Abrams will. In order
to follow up on Amr's question about the mid-month timeline, can you articulate then why this decision was not, why it did not take place sooner, given Ukrainians' demands and given the demands of a potential spring offensive?
You could ask that question about almost any system that we provided, and my answer will always be the same. We are in constant conversation with the Ukrainians about their needs and doing the best we can to address those needs, both short-term and long-term. And the decision that the president announced today was a result of a lot of conversations with the Ukrainians as well as with our allies and partners. And it is very much, as I answered before, it's very much about forecasting. It's about trying to get ahead of the kinds of fighting that we see coming in coming months here in the spring and the summer of this year.
Let me follow up, and to broaden out actually beyond the situation in Russia and Ukraine, I was struck by something the president said today about ensuring that neighbors cannot steal other neighbors' territory. It's something you all have brought up many, many times. And I'm curious if you can kind of help us understand why the administration has not changed course on your predecessor, former President Donald Trump's position on the Golan Heights, and what makes that situation distinct from what's going on in Russia and Ukraine.
Look, different scenarios completely, and I'm not here prepared to talk much about that, except to say we've been very consistent that we want to see a two-state solution, and we believe, the president believes, that a two-state solution is possible and could be viable, but it takes both sides to be willing to commit to that, and we don't want to see either side take unilateral actions that would decrease the possibility of actually reaching a two-state solution.
Could you please bring us a little bit behind the scenes about the negotiations?
You're behind her. I can't see it.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could give us some details about the negotiations behind the scenes with the Europeans.
Behind the scenes at the podium.
Yeah, especially what type of conversations have there been with the European Union and with the government of Spain?
The discussions have been very robust with our European allies and partners, again, for many weeks here, and certainly the discussion today that the president had with the with his counterparts in the UK, France, Germany, and Italy was, again, very productive, very candid. All these leaders are rightly focused on doing what they can to help Ukraine and rightly focused on the future. I can't speak for Spanish decision-making here. Spain obviously has been a contributor and a supporter of Ukraine, and that's always welcome. And I think the president addressed some of their contributions today, and we look forward to continuing to work closely with Spain going forward.
James, in the back.
I'm sorry. No, okay. Thank you.
Wait. You don't have a question, James? Are you kidding me?
Can we just have it for the record?
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to frame that transcript.
This is simply a tribute to your own loquacity and thoroughness in briefing.
Loquacity is James Rosen for eloquence.
I have two questions for you.
Go ahead.
So we don't know how Russia will respond, but if Moscow chooses a major escalation and decides to strike NATO, either Poland or the Baltics, does the NATO, do you have enough troops in the region right now to respond, and from day one, not 5 months ahead? And the second question would be, many of those who called for sending Leopard and Abrams to Ukraine argued that Russia right now is too weakened, to respond conventionally in a significant way. How confident are you in this assessment that Russia is so weak that, or maybe you have a different assessment, but many people think that Russia is too weak to respond in a significant way to the move that was just announced about tanks?
Let me take the second one first. There's no question that Russia's military is weaker today than it was 11 months ago. When you talk about the resources and the casualties that they have sunk into this unprovoked war of theirs, and the literally thousands of missiles and rockets and now drones that they have launched into Ukrainian territory. I mean, they have burned through a lot of inventory, and they have suffered a lot of casualties, killed and wounded. So there's no question that their military is weaker for Putin's folly here. That said, you don't have to look very far. Just the news coverage to see that the Russian military and their thugs are still pretty lethal, because Ukrainians continue to die every day. So I think if you were to ask a Ukrainian here, how weak is Russia, I don't think that they would tell you that there's not still fight left there. And that's why we're so focused on making sure that Ukraine can continue to defend itself and to have the capabilities to fight back and to succeed on the battlefield. On your first question, all I can tell you is we have seen absolutely no indication that Mr. Putin has designs on striking NATO territory. And President Biden has said since the very beginning of this conflict that we take our Article 5 commitments to NATO seriously. Article 5, of course, is the notion that an attack on one is an attack on all. And we take that seriously. In fact, we take it so seriously that President Biden ordered an additional 20,000 American troops alone onto the European continent, and they still are there. Now, we'll be rotating them in and out, but the net number of 100,000 American troops on the European continent has stayed the same and will stay the same for the foreseeable future. Make no mistake, the security environment in Europe has changed. Not is changing, not will change. It has changed because of what Mr. Putin did. And the United States anteed up for that and made clear to our NATO allies, particularly on the eastern flank, how seriously we take our responsibilities to those Article 5 commitments. And Mr. Putin needs to understand that.
But do you have enough troops? Because many of those countries send its own tanks, missile systems to Ukraine.
Well, we're sending missile systems, and now we're sending tanks to Ukraine as well. Every nation is making these decisions as best they can to support Ukraine, but they also still have sovereign responsibilities to their citizens to defend their countries. And so they're all making that calculus, as are we. I can tell you that from our perspective, I can't speak for every NATO ally, we are confident that we have the capability, the energy, the talent, the manpower, the resources to meet our Article 5 commitments to our NATO allies.
Are there any signs of a nuclear threat?
Thank you, Korean John. Got two questions about China. First, Korean told us yesterday that the U.S. has been communicating with China about the implications of helping Russia. Can you tell us what China's response was to U.S. communication? And if China continues to provide economic support, and including by selling non-lethal military aid to Russia, would the U.S. impose stronger measures than just communicate?
I won't get ahead of decisions that have been made, and I'm certainly not going to detail diplomatic conversations. We've been very clear publicly, and we certainly have been clear in private settings with Chinese leaders that we don't believe that now is the time for business as usual with Russia.
And that was the White House briefing. Updates on the war between Russia and Ukraine and the United States' position on supporting Ukraine. That's all for today. I'm Naima Latif. You've been listening to On Air Daily News And we welcome your good news. There are many good deeds happening. Feel free to call them in, 515-605-9749. During our broadcast, we share your good news. Until tomorrow, enjoy the rest of your day.